Welcome to another podcast with Julie Goodnight. Thanks for listening and enjoy Julie talking to you about all of your horse questions. Julie offers lots of free training advice at juliegoodnight.com. Be sure to check out the training library link at the top of the page. While you're there, make sure you also sign up for the free e-news. I'm Heidi Nyland Malaco. Thanks for joining us here today and watch Horse Master every Monday, Friday, and Saturday on RFD TV.
Hello, this is Sherry Swartz, and I have on the line with me Julie Goodnight. Julie, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Sherry. Thanks.
Good. Julie, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, your philosophy on horse training to get us started.
I am a horse trainer, been in the horse business my entire life, and I'm 52, so that's a few decades. And I grew up on a horse farm. I actually grew up in Florida, although I've lived the last 25 years in Colorado. I grew up riding on the Hunter Jumper Circuit in Florida. You know, we're talking about 40 years ago. It was a day and age when the retired cavalry officers had a big influence on horsemanship. Most of the trainers were retired. Most of my trainers, anyway, were retired cavalry officers, which was a great thing for me. They were kind of mean, but I learned a lot. And they, of course, were very heavily based in dressage. So although I was riding Hunter Jumper, I grew up under a very heavy dressage influence, what we know of today as classical riding. I became a horse trainer, when I was a teenager, people started paying me to ride horses and worked my way through college training horses. And then I didn't really plan to be in the horse business when I was going to college, but lo and behold, I graduated from college, and next thing you knew, I got offered a job running a training farm. So I just kind of stayed in the horse business. I am really most often characterized as a natural horsemanship trainer, which I am, and I'm very proud to wear that title, although it's somewhat self-taught. I'm not a follower of any one style, so to speak. But really, I think the best way to describe my training philosophies is as a combination of both classical and natural horsemanship. So I very strongly rooted in classical horsemanship, but with a real serious natural horsemanship slant to it.
Let's talk a little bit about that natural horsemanship, that term, because I think there's a lot of misconception out there about that. And I certainly use those methods with my own horses, although I'm not a horse trainer, just a horse enthusiast. You know, I've actually had people who, you know, they look at me and, you know, they say, oh, you're one of those. And there's a huge misconception about that. And it's not about love, loving on your horse. So let's talk about that natural.
No, not at all. I think some people do think of it as a very touchy-feely kind of thing, but I wouldn't consider it that way. And to me, natural horsemanship means you're behavior-based in your training. And to me, it means knowing and understanding the horse's natural behavior and then using that information to communicate with him in a way that's understandable to him, because it's all based on horse behavior. And to me, that's pretty simple and clear. But like anything, there are trends in the horse business and fads, and certainly natural horsemanship has really come of age in the last 20 years, let's say. And there are many different brands and flavors and so to speak. But natural horsemanship certainly doesn't buy you any free pass, because there are, just like any horse trainers out there, some of them are good and some of them are bad. Some of them are ethical and some of them aren't. And so just because they wear the tag of natural horsemanship trainer doesn't mean they're a good trainer, doesn't mean they're a humane trainer, doesn't, you know. So it's certainly not any kind of declaration. And it is a broadly used term.
Mm-hmm.
In my training, I really like to focus on science-based training and not, just kind of whimsical stuff. So to me, natural horsemanship is very, very based in the scientific understanding of horse behavior and training techniques.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I think you, I think just summing it all up with that first statement that you made, natural behavior-based training is really a good way to kind of explain it, because it is reading the horse and then doing what it, what he needs you to do.
So I think I hear, I think this is what you were alluding to earlier. I hear a lot of people use the term natural horsemanship in such a way that it's some kind of touchy-feely kind of thing. But it's not, because horses are not touchy-feely animals. They can be, but they also kick and bite and strike and run each other around, and they're very mean and brutal to each other. So, you know, it's the leadership qualities that you have to have. You have to be willing to step up there and discipline a horse if it's required. And so to me, that's natural, because that's the way horses treat each other. But I do think for a small number of people, they think it's some kind of touchy-feely indulge. I'm never going to, you know, I don't want to have to put my horse in a pen,
right,
and I don't want to have to do this, and, you know, I would never hit my horse. And so.
Right, yeah, yeah, right. And, yeah, I've actually had someone tell me, oh, you need a bigger bit on that horse. And I turned and I said, no, because it was unsolicited advice. And I turned and I said, no. I said, no. I said, I need to get to his mind. And once I get to his mind, then his feet will follow. And, you know, it was just kind of one of those situations where I had his mind at home, but then when I took him away from home, it was, you know, a whole different, you know, kind of like started all over again. So then it was like, okay, now what do I do here to get to his mind again? But anyways, that's kind of where that was all based, because I fielded that, some of those looks at, you know, that time. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that for our listeners, what natural horsemanship was all about, because it's, some people look down on it and don't like it, and I don't understand that, because I tell you what, as soon as you incorporate that into your training, I think you get so much farther ahead if you can incorporate it into your
It still requires a finesseful person with good timing and good sense of feel and touch and all of that. And that's why, I mean, it's no different for me. So just because you say you're a natural horsemanship trainer and you go through all the motions doesn't mean you're doing it right, number one. I see a lot of horses, and it is a joke amongst professionals, I can tell you. We see lot of horses that have been, I won't say ruined, but have been set back in their training through someone's attempt at natural horsemanship, particularly being clobbered around with a stick every time they, you know, every time they blink. And so it's, you know, it's like any other kind of horsemanship. I think it's, people do it well, people don't do it well.
You know,
but certainly there's a bias. They're not so much anymore. I don't see the bias nearly as you walk into almost any English barn on the East Coast, and you'll find somebody that has a rope halter in there. And what happens is, the when it is done right, the results are undeniable. And so I had a gal at a clinic that had been to several of my clinics, actually, and she told me that she was from a fancy English showborn. It was back east somewhere. I can't remember which state, but and she had been doing all this groundwork with her horse sort of behind the barn where nobody saw her. And then she practiced it to the point where her horse was working at liberty with her. And then she came into the arena when it was full of people and proceeded to go put her horse through the paces with him at liberty. And boy, she dropped some jaws. And she, with that one statement, she kind of converted almost everybody in the barn. So so it's definitely getting a broad range of acceptance.
I think so, more so now. I'm seeing just more and more trainers popping up with that title underneath their name. So anyways, let's move on a little bit. I was on your website and noticed that you had released a Master Canter DVD set. Let's talk a little bit about what you've included on that set for the folks who might want to go there and purchase that.
Well, it's pretty much everything you'd ever want to know about the canter. It's two different DVDs that are very different in presentation, but similar in content. The first is a part of my writing series, and it's a training DVD that's devoted entirely to the canter, starting with the mechanics of the gait and footfalls and leads and how you feel them and how you set the horse up, how you deal with lead problems, slowing down the canter, collecting the canter. All that is in one DVD right up through simple lead changes and flying lead changes. And then the other DVD in the series is a compilation of episodes from my TV show, which were all about the canter. And so there's five episodes on that DVD, and each one is a different topic. So one is about cueing for canter. One is about slowing down the canter. And it kind of progresses in that way. The fifth one is about flying lead changes. And the difference in that video is it's real students, and they're real horses, and they're real problems. So that's more me presenting the information in a coaching sort of situation. So it kind of reinforces what you learned on the training DVD. And you know, most people like what we look for in the TV show is we look for the most common riders on the most common horses with the most common problems, so that people watching the show go, that's exactly what I do, you know. And so that's kind of what's on the DVD then. And so we put that all together in a package because, the first of all, the canter DVD, my training DVD, is our number one selling DVD. And that just tells you, you know, the what everybody already knows is that people have the most problems at the canter. It is the most challenging gait because it is the most similar to the horse's flight response. And so, you know, that opens a Pandora's box to the potential problems that you can have. And so that's why we put it together in a package.
Sure. What would you say is the most common problem at the canter then? Or maybe the top two or three?
Well, yeah, top two or three would be easier. Certainly lead problems is right up there. And slowing down the canter certainly is right up there. You know, then you get, I'm trying to think if there's something as obvious as those two things. Just in lead problems, I would kind of categorize that also with departures. I mean, a lot of times, in fact, most of the time, lead problems are rider error, not horse error. And so you know, a lot of times it's just a matter of cueing, understanding cue better, setting the horse up better, understanding how you need to position your horse for the departure, and all of those things. So slowing down the canter, you know, bucking at the canter is pretty common, but thankfully not everybody has that problem.
let's talk about the departure then, or even the correct way to ask for a canter, because I think there's probably a lot of folks out there who don't really know that unless they've taken some specific lessons.
And even then, that doesn't mean they learned it right. The cue for canter is the most complicated cue because it's the most complicated gait. It's the only gait that the pattern of footfall changes when the horse changes direction. So, you know, when he walks and trots, no matter which way you turn, his footfalls are exactly the same. But at the canter, he has to change leads, which means he has to totally reorganize the pattern of footfalls while he's in the air to be on a different lead. And also it's complicated because it's a 3-beat gait and the horse has 4 legs. So the beats refer to the feet hitting the ground. So it's a complicated rhythm. The walk and trot both have a 2-beat rhythm. So the walk is 4 beats, the trot is 2 beats. So there's always a real clear, distinct 2-beat rhythm, the 4-beat. But the canter is da-da-dum, da-da-dum. You know, so it's a more complicated rhythm as well. And you have to understand, I believe, you could just teach someone and say, put your left foot there and your right hand here and now do this, you know, and maybe they'll figure it out. I think that's kind of what most people have been taught. But unless you really understand the mechanics of the gait, then your cueing's not going to be very articulate.
And there's actually a time to cue, isn't there, when even if you're at the, well, walk, or if you're starting out at the trot, then isn't there a correct time to cue?
You're treading dangerously close into thinking too much about it. Sometimes I have to calm students down. They just don't think too much about that, because if you think too hard, you miss the timing and the feel and the rhythm. The timing is more in timing with the horse's movement. So if you're just feeling the rhythm, you don't have to really think about that. The timing comes natural. But it is the correct timing is when your horse is positioned correctly to step off into the lead. And that all has to do with where his hips are at the moment you cue him, because he pushes off into the gate with his outside hind leg. And what you have to do to position your horse to take the correct lead is to position him where all of his weight is on his outside hind leg, so he steps into the correct lead. And that's very easily done by just pushing his hips to the inside. So if you just reach back with your outside leg, give a little pulsating pressure, the horse will hopefully bend his hips toward the inside. When he does that, his outside hind leg comes underneath him to the midline. And at that time, if you cue him, he will step into the correct lead. Mm-hmm. So the first part of the counter cue then is you reach about 6 inches back with your outside leg, give a little pulsating pressure in order to position the horse haunches in. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
It would make a lot more sense if you could see all the gesticulation I was doing and the way I was positioning my body as I talked about it. So it's hard in this format when you're used to talking with your hands and I put a lot of body language into my teaching. So that's the first part of the cue, outside leg. The second part of the cue, now, you know, the other thing that's complicated about canter cue is different trainers teach it differently. And there are different cues for canter. What I teach is the most classical cue and what I believe is the most correct cue. But when we get to the second part of the cue, that's where you start hearing variations. Pretty much everybody uses the outside leg because that positioning haunches in has to occur for the horse to take the correct lead.
Right.
The second part of the cue is a rein aid. And I teach people to use a lift of the inside rein, not a pull back on the inside rein. That will interfere with your departure. But just a lift. In fact, I actually reach forward with my hand as I lift it, reach towards my horse's inside ear. So if I'm cueing for the left lead, I'd, you know, reach my left hand towards his left ear. What this this sets the horse up to take the correct lead in front. So, you know, again, understanding the mechanics of the gait, you would have to understand that the correct lead is both in front and behind. And hind always comes first because that's where his movement originates. So with your lift of the inside rein, what you're doing is encouraging the horse to lift that shoulder so that he will also step into the correct lead on front. This lift in your rein also repositions your weight slightly so that your weight comes on to the outside, which is where it's going to naturally be when he's cantering. And that kind of gets into how you feel your leads, but if we talked about that, that would make sense. So when the horse canters, because he picks up his inside legs higher and he reaches farther forward with his inside legs, it shifts your weight to his outside. So his back, where you're sitting, is actually crooked at the canter, leaning you a little bit to the outside. So when you lift that inside rein, it's basically putting you in the position of that lead, of where you're going to be when the horse is on that lead. So you got outside leg, inside rein. The third and final part of the cue comes from your seat. And all you do with your seat is push in the canter motion, which is a motion just like you were pushing a swing. And it's the motion, when you canter, your hips make a circle. They push forward and down and up and back and circle, circle, circle. So what you do to finally cue your horse to canter is start moving your seat in the canter motion, which is that pushing, that swing pushing motion. And he already knows you're asking him to canter because you went through the sequence. First you prepared him for the cue, made sure he was awake and alert and listening to you. Then I would cue my horse in a rhythm about like this. After I'd wake him up and he was paying attention to me, I'd go outside leg, inside rein, push with the seat. So by the time you're pushing with the seat, he already knows you're cueing him for canter because the way you use your legs was different, the way you use your reins was different, and because you use that sequence every time, he knows the third part of the sequence. When you push with the seat, it means to canter. So that's the canter cue.
And all right, well, then let's talk about horses who you give the cue and they kind of, you know, shoot like a rocket into the canter. And then of course, the riders, you know, grab
the rein. That's a real common problem. That would be right there. If we expanded our list to the top five, that would definitely be in there. And if I said it once, I've said it 1,000 times. If your horse appears as though he was shot out of a cannon when you cue him, you over-cued him. That's the entire answer to that. And so you can over-prepare a horse and you can over-cue him in many different ways. And so if you have a horse that is eager to move forward, a more forward horse, a horse with too much go, those are the ones that people usually have this trouble with, because they take a lesson and somebody explains what I just said. Now put your outside leg here and now push there and then do this. Well, that horse, you probably don't have to use legs on at all. That horse, you just think canter and they canter. You don't really have to cue them to canter. You allow them to canter. And so it's the same cue, but just toned down by 1,000 times. And in fact, one of the episodes on the Canter Master DVD is that very subject. And it was an Arabian sport horse. I believe it was an Arabian Tricaner cross. Very, very cute horse. Very forward. And he was just exploding into a bucking fit when this kid would cue him to canter. And it was a good rider, and it wasn't obvious to me that the kid was over cueing him, because he was a good rider, equitation rider. So a lot of times I have to get on the horse to understand it, and I did. And I actually got really nice approaches from the horse right away, but just by doing that, I didn't use legs at all. Didn't even, you know, hardly prepare the horse at all. Just go from a nice, easy sitting trot to moving my hips in the canter rhythm, and the horse just step right into the canter. So, but that's covered in the DVD. But it really is getting down to the horse's level of sensitivity, and which is grossly less than what you think it is, particularly those hot-blooded horses. I mean, that's what hot-blooded is. The definition of hot-blooded is a horse that's highly sensitive to environmental stimuli. But that's all stimuli, sound, smells, movement, touch. They feel mental pressure much more keenly. So those kind of horses, you really do the same thing, just way less of it.
Yeah, I completely understand that. I have a thoroughbred who he likes to go.
Funny how that happens with thoroughbreds.
Yeah. he's not uncontrollable when he goes, mm-hmm. but, and my daughter, she's now 12 and she's becoming a pretty good rider, and so I'm letting her ride him, and they're making a good combination because she's like, Mom, I just have to think about the next gate, and we're in it. And I'm thinking, good.
So
she's teaching
already
her
coming
how
to hit.
Be,
mm-hmm.
Was
he on the racetrack?
Yeah.
Well,
years
that's
ago,
a whole nother,
I bought him off the track.
Uh-huh. And that's a whole nother, we could do a whole show on that. I rode racehorses all through college, so understanding what those horses know is really useful.
I did that for one summer in college. I exercised racehorses.
Uh-huh. But, fun stuff.
Anyway, yeah, crazy.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, with the thoroughbreds especially, but this is true of all horses, it's just magnified with thoroughbreds. The tighter mm-hmm. you hold the reins, the faster they go.
Right.
Horses on the racetrack are actually, that's trained into them. Well, the way you stop a horse is you sit down and drop the reins on his neck. And he goes, we're done. And so what happens is people get these off the track horses, and they do have a lot of go. They're they've been bred for hundreds of generations to do nothing but run fast, and so they get nervous, so they start holding the reins tighter, so the horse goes faster, so they hold them tighter. So that's probably the most common problem that you see in those off the track horses. But that can be true of any forward horse. It's a very, very common problem. We've done several TV episodes on this. People holding the reins too tight causes the horse to go faster. The horse begins to run through the bridle. The horse runs into pressure or is trying to run away from the pressure that's coming from the reins being too tight. So that's pretty much every clinic I deal with at least one, if not several people that are having that problem. Sometimes they're thoroughbred, sometimes they're not. It could be any mm-hmm. Forward sensitive horse.
Yeah. What's your method for slowing that horse down? Because I know, and I've certainly been on a horse that does that, and I've had to just drop the reins in an arena with a trainer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just drop the reins, and this particular trainer just said, just let go of the reins. Just drop your reins. I mean, I had hold of them, but don't obviously have any. Just mm-hmm. a big loop in the rein. And what mm-hmm. he had me do was just let him go. He said, because at mm-hmm. some point he's going to figure out it's a heck of a lot easier to go slow than it is easier to go fast. But we spent a lot
true
of time doing that.
Some horses, but not all horses.
Uh-huh.
That is not true, especially of Arabians.
They have a ton
because
of endurance.
What happens is they just get fitter and fitter and fitter.
Yeah, right.
We did that on the racetrack all the time when the horses would run away with you. It'd usually be an older, very sage gelding. They run away with you sometimes. And the first time, it was really scary. And then, the trainer said, what's to be scared of? He's not, the only thing to be scared of is the butt chewing you get when you get back to the barn for letting that horse run away with you. But he's going to stop. He's going to run out of oxygen eventually, and he's going to probably going to stay on the track. So you just kind of go with him and let him go. But you can't. That can backfire, especially on Arabians, because they just build more and more endurance, and so you're training that into them. Also with anything. And I don't disagree with what he said, because sometimes you have to let the horse figure it out. But I'm also a real big believer in habitual behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And horses in particular are very prone to habitual behavior because they like patterns, they like routines, right? We know that about horses. They love to know what's coming next. And it's real easy to build a bad pattern into your routine. And so if every time you cued him to canter, let's say, he went too fast and you just let him go too fast until he got tired and slowed down, is that necessarily training him that you want him to go slow to begin with? Or is that training him that you want him to go fast until he's out of oxygen? So very often with horses, not just in this circumstances, but in almost anything you think of, it becomes a scenario, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Is the rider doing that because of what the horse did, or is the horse doing that because of what the rider did? And it can start out one way and then go the other way. So, you know, jigging is a classic example of that. You know, that almost always ends up being trained into the horse by the rider. And at some point, the horse, he isn't even doing it on purpose. He thinks he has to. He thinks he's supposed to. So, but letting go of the reins, holding two reins at the same time is probably the biggest cause of horses going too fast at the canter. Canter is a fear-inducing gait, so people naturally want to clench up on the reins, and that causes it. And when horses get a little nervous, they want to go faster. That's their flight response. That's what horses do. So then the rider's holding the reins even tighter. Now the horse's mouth is hurting. What does he want to do when things frighten him and hurt him? He wants to run away from them. So he starts going faster. And so you get this pattern of behavior that becomes very ingrained in the horse. If you've been doing that every day you rode him for the last year, wow, that's some really seriously habitual behavior now, and it almost doesn't matter where it came from to begin with. We have to break that pattern, and we have to create a new normal, so to speak, ingrain some different habitual behavior in him.
Mm-hmm. And how do you go about breaking that pattern? I mean, what would be your response? Somebody brought you a horse that was just, you know,
well,
going
too fast.
Well,
that's what I do for a living. You know, I do it in every clinic that I do, and in almost every presentation, at least whenever I do presentations on problem horses, I would say easily a third of the riders that I have in clinics have some sort of unproductive pattern in their riding. Sometimes it's real severe, like we were just talking about, you know, just the wild, crazy runaway at the canter kind of thing. Or sometimes it's, you know, horses that are getting out of control or jigging or something like that. Sometimes it's just little bad habits in the rider that have created a bad habit in the horse, you know, but there's a pattern and a cycle that needs to be broken. So you have to identify, you know, what the problem is and then what's causing the problem. And that's the hard part. I think to people watching my clinics, when I start trying to point things out, I think it's obvious to them once I point it out. But being able to discern that problem before I just point it out, you know, like you can look at it and see there's a problem, but you don't know what's causing the problem. And something like holding two reins relentlessly, most people look at that and not see a problem because they think, of course, they're pulling on two reins. The horse is going too fast. They don't understand that that's causing the horse to go too fast. And draping those reins down on the horse's neck is not the intuitive solution to that problem. So most people wouldn't think to do that. Most people think you're crazy, in fact, when you ask them to do that. So, you know, that's usually when I have to get up on a horse and show what I mean. This is how I would do that. And, gee, look at the response of the horse. In that instance of the horse is too fast at the canter because the rider's holding two reins relentlessly, those horses are instant fixes. Instantly, for me, they will canter slowly and relax on a loose rein. Getting the rider to break the pattern and the horse to believe the rider when they try to break the pattern takes forever. I shouldn't say that. Sometimes people get it right away. But the rider has the same pattern ingrained in them that the horse does. And so the horse, from the horse's point of view, he's going, I know she's going to do it again. I know she's going to do it again. I better start going fast now. And then it always becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because then the rider has that rein pattern of holding on to two reins, holding on for dear life with the reins. And so it's tough. It's very tough to break patterns. But that's pretty much what I do in clinics, is we try to find those. Again, that's kind of a severe example, but we all have little, you know, even in doing groundwork with horses, you know, you might have little patterns that you've developed with your horse that aren't very productive. But, and you think you're doing it because of what the horse is doing, but the horse thinks he's doing it because of what you're doing.
Right. Right. And I think that's where it becomes important. I think a lot of people get stuck in some point of their training because of that exact situation. And you don't have somebody there saying, you know what, here's what I'm seeing you're doing. So I think that's where it becomes important to work with a trainer, you know,
Absolutely. Every
once in a while, at least every once in a while, to help break those patterns. Mm-hmm. And in person, you know, it's hard, and attend clinics and mm-hmm. whatnot, because it's always an ongoing education. And then, so we've talked about too fast at the canter is, you know, really you have to identify the problem and is it a rider error? Is it, you know, the rider and the horse combination, and kind of go from there, because you're going to have different, you know, you're going to have a different advice for the different mm-hmm. problems that you see there.
Mm-hmm. I think the two we've touched on, though, are far and away the biggest problems, is over cueing the horse and holding two reins too tight.
And that's probably, do you see where people over cue and then they also have a horse who's going too fast at the canter?
Exactly.
It's probably, those probably go hand in hand, because I wouldn't imagine you've got a horse who's like not really, is not a forward mover. Mm-hmm. He's not going to be one that shoots into the canter. He's probably not going to be one that wants to canter too fast. He's going to be looking for the stop.
I would say they're very commonly related, but you might have a horse that's actually kind of lazy that has learned to go too fast at the canter from holding the reins too tight. So they don't have to be related. They can be related, but they don't have to be.
Mm-hmm. So maybe if someone's at home, and let's say they're trying to fix this problem at home, what are some things that they should look for? One, obviously, you just mentioned it was over-cueing. And then the second thing you mentioned, obviously, was holding your reins too tight. So what's maybe the third thing, the third or fourth thing that they could look for in their own body position that might be contributing to that horse moving too fast?
Well, immediately what comes to mind is the rider that's both leaning forward and leaning in. And that throws the horse off balance, and so he tries to speed up to catch up with you, basically. So I would say, you know, the body position of the rider. So if and those, again, those two might be together, or they could conceivably be separate. So somebody might be sitting up straight but leaning to the inside. But often they go together. If you're leaning the inside, you're probably leaning forward too, because the horse is going too fast. But, you know, when you're sitting in a correct and balanced position on the horse, what you're balanced over is the center of gravity. And when you're sitting up nice and tall and everything feels just right, and you feel comfortable and balanced on your horse, you are in synchronization with his center of gravity. Just like if you were carrying somebody piggyback, you know how you can feel when their center of gravity is lined up with yours, and you can feel when it's not. If they lean to one side or lean back or forward, you feel your balance affected. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when you're riding, your horse feels that. He knows when you're in balance with him, and he knows when you're not. One of the ways in which we use our seat aid, which is the most important aid of communication that you have with the horse, is to play with that center of gravity. So when we want the horse to slow down and we sit back and deepen the saddle, our center of gravity comes behind his, and that is the primary cue that you want him to slow down. It's real easy for him to feel and understand. So he comes to your center of gravity. Well, conversely, when you bring your center of gravity in front of his, it feels like a cue to speed up to him. And not only that, but when you start getting in front of the horse's motion or getting too far forward, as your upper body goes forward, your lower legs go back, and you actually start squeezing the horse more. And so now your center of gravity is telling him to go faster, and your legs are telling him to go faster. So a horse that has too much go in him will always default to that. He's always going to take the go cue, even if he didn't mean it as a go cue. And then when you're cantering and you go to make a turn, that's when things fall apart at the canter for most people, is in the turn. Going straight, not so hard. But you get in the turn, and if the rider starts leaning to the inside, it causes the horse's weight to get thrown to the inside, which is opposite of where it should be. So remember I talked about earlier, if he's on the right lead, for instance, he picks his right legs up higher, both the hind and the fore, and he reaches farther forward with those right legs. And so if you look at his back, the right side of his back would be more elevated than the left side of his back. So from the saddle, when you're riding the canter correctly, your weight is in your outside seat bone and your outside stirrup. Well, what happens, people that don't know this, they just naturally want to lean to the inside on a turn like you were riding a bicycle or a motorcycle. So that weight, if the rider's weight comes to the inside, the horse is now being thrown pretty severely off balance. And what does he do when he gets off balance? You know? He speeds up. Same thing you and I would do, actually. You know, if I trip over my spurs a lot, so I'll be walking along, trip over my spurs. What I do is run a few steps to regain my balance.
You move your feet
well,
faster.
So the horse is even more that way. When he gets out of balance, he wants to speed up because the reason why he's more that way is because of his flight response. You know, falling down is the worst thing that could happen to a horse in his mind. And so getting out of balance gets his attention and it makes him speed up. So I would say that would be a right up there at the top.
What about a horse that doesn't want to get into the canter? Do you have that?
That does not, will not pick up the canter?
Yeah. He's just too lazy, or if he, you know, when he's asked, he bucks.
So, you know, then we enter a whole different set of problems and kind of have to think about, what the most common cause of those problems. Well, you know, without question, the most common cause is the rider. These are pretty much all rider problems. But it might be that the rider is pulling on the reins too much when the horse needs to go forward. That I'll explain that a little bit more. It might be that the rider has spoiled the horse and has trained the horse that he is allowed to be disobedient. A lot of things that the rider could do, just the rider not having the authority. I would say authority, the rider interfering with the horse through position would be the big thing, and then the rider having a general lack of authority with the horse. You know, another thing we could talk about there is understanding the amount of pressure that motivates a horse. Getting back to the rider, when the horse steps into, well, first of all, every stride of the canter, a horse's head drops down. On that third beat, his head drops down, especially on the very first stride when he's launching his whole body from not moving to moving fast with a lot of suspension. On that very first stride, his head drops even farther down than it does once he's got the momentum going. And so what happens, this is probably the single biggest factor when people are having problems getting the horse into the canter. If at the moment the horse goes to step into the canter and lunges nose forward, the rider either does not release the rein or, worse, picks up on the rein, which is what, so that rider, you know, that's scared of the canter, what's going to happen, as soon as the horse, he feels that the horse is starting to canter, that rider's going to go, and pick up on the reins. At the same moment, this horse's nose is diving down into the canter. Well, how many times do you think he's going to do that for you? Once is about it.
Yeah.
And after that, he's not going to canter. He won't do it. Why would he do that? It hurts. And you're giving him a conflicting signal. And because he's a lazy horse, he defaults to the stop cue. Whereas the horse we were talking about previously defaulted to the go cue. So I, over and over and over again at clinics, have to remind people. First, I have them watch a horse that's cantering and watch, see that nose going down every single stride. And then now let's watch a departure and see that the nose goes down even farther on that stride. And I explain to them like how it is so, so important that the horse has a release at that moment. Mm-hmm. And this can cause really big training problems. The horse that you were talking before about, the horse that explodes into the canter, this can mm-hmm. often be the cause of that as well. Yeah. And mm-hmm. because it's so anxiety-inducing that the horse becomes afraid of the canter departure. And the I've written about this a lot on my website, but sometimes you come across these horses that once you get them cantering, they do fine. They go slow. They're nice and, you know, collected and responsive. But for the first few strides, it's like they're shot out of a cannon. For the first few strides, they're kind of wild and crazy. That's a horse mm-hmm. that's afraid of the departure because he's been hit in the mouth on departure. Mm-hmm. So, but that would be a real sensitive horse. So, but for a lazy, insensitive horse, he's just going to default to the go cue to the stop cue every time the rider touches him in the mouth when he tries to canter. So he's at most going to try it two or three times before he totally gives up on the rider and just shuts down and says, I'm not doing that. Just, you can't make me. And so that's a rider problem. That has to be understood and corrected. And the general lack of authority is that if a horse does not see you as the captain, he doesn't think he has to do that. And so but he might be a pretty good horse and he might be pretty well trained, so he's willing to do most everything else that you ask. Like, he's willing to walk around there, and he's willing to trot around there. Okay, I'll do a few circles, and, you know, maybe I'll do this. But yeah, humor you. But at some point when you ask him to do something he doesn't want to do, he just says, no, I'm not going to do that, and you can't make me.
Mm-hmm.
So the solution to that is to get more authority over your horse, and you do that primarily through groundwork. I have written a lot on this subject of authority. I mean, if you did a search in my training library of the times I used the word authority, who knows how many hits you'd get. But so that's kind of a much huger problem. You're having many other problems if that's the case. It's just that you don't know it yet. But the one thing you know is you can't get your horse to canter. So that's, again, where you go to a clinic and a lesson or whatever, and you get some third-party objective eyes on you and go, you know, wait a minute, that horse is getting away with murder.
Yeah,
But you thought he was just fine.
Right, yeah. I can certainly relate to that. I have a horse who is very dominant and lazy. And mm-hmm. I didn't realize until I started working with and I've had horses for a long time, but until I started working with a trainer, I didn't realize just everything he does, this horse does, is a dominant thing.
Yeah, and that's what I was talking about earlier with the patterns and stuff that people don't even know are there.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Those are very tough horses, dominant and lazy.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize even if when he's tied and he's and I'm trying to saddle him, and he'll like, you know, put his shoulder into me. Just take a step towards me. Put his shoulder into me. I never realized that was something that I could correct. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, as soon as I started getting very specific with this horse, and it's not my thoroughbred, with this horse, very specific about where his feet are, you know, I have to go out there and say, no, I don't want your foot there. I want it here.
Yeah.
Nope, not there. I want
it
here.
That's what we do in groundwork in my clinics. But you're absolutely right. And that's what I was saying. If your problem is you can't get into the canter because you have a general lack of authority with your horse, that's why you have to go back to the groundwork. You have to gain total control of that horse from nose to tail, including all 4 feet. And that's best done on the ground. But, you know, the lazy horse and this issue you bring up reminds me of the final thing I wanted to say, which is to understand how much pressure to use to motivate a horse. And there's a science-based concept in the training of all animals, and I always like to remind people this works on husbands too. And it says that whatever the animal is doing right now is what he's most motivated to be doing. And if you wish to change that behavior, you have to find the amount of pressure that motivates change. And so, first of all, we have to understand what is pressure. It's not just physical. We also put mental pressure. So if you were using the human world to talk about this theory of finding the amount of pressure that motivates change, I like to use the analogy of the high-level corporate executive that's, you know, pulling down, you know, $1 million in salary. He's working, you know, 70, 80 hours a week in a very high-pressure job, a lot of stresses, a lot of toll on his life, but the pressure that motivates him is the money he's making. And so a lot of times with horses, a lot of times we are talking about physical pressure, using your leg or the rein or whatever, but there's also mental pressure included in this. And so finding the amount of pressure that motivates change is what is required to train horses. And the problem is for each and every horse, that amount of pressure is different. And for each and every circumstance, the amount of pressure required could be different because it depends a lot on how motivated the horse was to be acting that way to begin with. And the best example I can give you of this is kind of a graphic example, but I think it's a good one. If you've ever seen a stallion breeding a mare live cover, right before that stallion breeds that mare, he is a highly, highly motivated animal. Would you agree?
No, absolutely. I've actually helped with breeding.
Okay, so then this will make all the sense in the world to you. And so the amount of pressure that would be required to dissuade him right before he mounts that mare is a pretty intense amount of pressure. That's why you've got a chain over his lip. You've got a whip in your hand. You've got a big, strong, capable person on the end of that lead in case something goes wrong and you have to dissuade that horse. If you have to change his behavior when he's that highly motivated, it is going to take a lot of pressure. So we have to apply that into everything you do with the horse. And you have to find the amount of pressure that motivates him to change. And this is tough with those lazy, insensitive, and dominant horses because they will take a lot of pressure. And they're generally pretty motivated to be lazy. And so you have to be willing to dish out the pressure when it's needed. Now, those same horses, once they know you'll dish the pressure out, you'll never have to use that pressure again. But they have to know you're willing to do it before they're going to become compliant and obedient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. So you think usually just one or two times of, let's say, you know, you need to make him move out of your way and he's not moving, and you take your, you know, end of the lead rope or, you know, your crop or whatever you've got in your hand. Well, not a board, but you know what I'm saying. A crop or, you know, lunge whip or something. Yeah, and whack him. Like I said, move.
Yeah.
As long as
but
he knows that that's what you mean.
I would also be stomping my feet and waving my arms, and I call it hissing and spitting at a horse. John Lyons says, I've heard him say this a number of times, it always cracks me up. And when I've heard him say this in reference to a horse that bites, and that we don't want to get into, that's a whole other topic, but he says, you act like you're going to kill that horse. And if there's a shovel sitting next to you, pick it up and act like you're going to kill the horse with it, but only for 3 seconds. And
right.
But the horse has to see, and that gets more into mental pressure. So, I might, you know, swing the rope at him or you know, bump him with my stick, but I would also be, you know, screaming at him and hissing and spitting at him and stomping my feet, and so that his eyes got big and he backed across the arena going, whoa, what happened there, you know? So find the amount of pressure that motivates and use everything that you've got.
Yeah. Well, and I have a quick story for that, because it's this same dominant horse. Last summer, for some reason, he decided he didn't want me to touch his chest. I don't know why. Usually he liked me to scratch his chest. There was no problem there. There wasn't, you know, no issues, no soreness, no pain. And I realized it was a dominant issue. He just all of a sudden decided, no, you can't touch me there. And so I was working on that. And then I was going to ride him, and I had walked him through a gate, and I went to close the gate, and I needed him to back up a few steps. And so I just reached down, not even thinking about it, I just reached down and went to push him with my hand, or, you know, just put my fingers on his chest to move him back, and he pinned his ears. He didn't actually bite me, but he threatened is what he was doing. And I immediately reacted. Thank heavens I had the end of the lead rope in my hand. I had a nice long rope on him. I had an end of the lead rope in my hand, and I just immediately reacted and just slammed him on the nose with that lead rope. And then I just turned around and went back to the gate. It's like, you know, that's what you get, you know. You know, he never tried it again.
Well,
he
that's exactly what would have happened in a herd setting.
Yeah.
If he had done something rude to a superior horse, to a horse that was higher in the hierarchy, he would have gotten the same instant correction. And, you know, the other problem is the alternative is that you back away from the horse at that moment, and then you've reinforced his ear pinning. So, unfortunately, that happens a lot. A lot of the bad behaviors, particularly in terms of ground manners, have been sort of taught to the horse by the handler reacting incorrectly and not really having that understanding of that spatial awareness. And, you know, horses, there's only two factors involved in dominance, and one of them is spatial. So the dominant horse always relinquishes his space the subordinate horse always relinquishes space to the dominant horse. So that little thing you were talking about of him moving his shoulder, these little subtle things that they do that time and time again to them prove they're dominant, that the human didn't even notice the horse was doing to begin with.
You know,
when he bumps his nose into you and crowds you with his shoulder, it can be very, very subtle. And so what's happening is these people that have problematic relationships with these horses is all day, every day, this horse is doing these little things that are dominant, and the human doesn't even know, isn't even aware of it. And so the human thinks they're dominant, but the horse thinks he's dominant. And often that can lead to a really bad outcome, because what happens when humans think they're dominant, but they're not, and horses know it, eventually those horses become disdainful of that human. And eventually it's as if the horse is saying, who do you think you are, pretending like you are the boss of me? How many times do I have to tell you you're not? I'm sick of you being an imposter. And at some point, generally, the horse will lash out, and that's when they start biting or kicking or, you know, something.
Yeah, I completely agree. And then
they come to me and they've got a problem with it. My horse bites. Well, that's a very, very late stage problem that you've been reinforcing that horse dominance for a long time without even knowing it. So the solution is not so much how do I deal with the horse biting me as how do I regain authority and leadership over my horse.
Absolutely. And I can attest to that. I spent, because this was my most challenging horse that I've had because of that. And I haven't had a super dominant horse like this before. And I spent quite a long time, more than I care to admit, letting them get away with those type of things and not even realizing that that's what was going on, thinking I was dominant, you know.
Well, you
not
know,
realizing that was going on.
That's really, really common. But fortunately, most horses are well-tempered and well-trained enough to where even though they don't think you're the boss of them, they'll still do most things that you ask. It's not the ideal relationship, but a lot of horses are just so well-tempered and they have enough training that they'll just kind of go along. But one like you're describing that's more dominant in temperament, those are the ones you run into more trouble with. And even if you had a less dominant one and the horse was just going along with, and humoring you, as you said, that relationship could be 100 times better if you could gain more authority and leadership over the horse, because he wants leadership. They thrive with leadership.
Well, I can tell you that my relationship with him has completely changed since I've gotten more specific about what I want from him and not as lenient, you know, with allowing him to get away with some of that, you know, stepping towards me or, you know, I'm saddling him and he, you know, bulges his shoulder or, you know, whatever, these little tricks that he does. And as soon as I just got specific with what I wanted there, and a lot of it was on the ground. I started saying, okay, when I'm leading you, I want you here, not there, not over here, here.
Absolutely.
And I just got very specific, and it was a trainer who helped me do this in my area. That's when it changed. I mean, everything changed, even, you know, our trail riding, everything I asked that horse to do has completely changed. And it was
absolutely, and that's
amazing.
You know, that's why it's so important to do the groundwork, and that's why I start every clinic. And you'd be surprised how many people come to clinics having already done a lot of groundwork, but there's problems with it. There's animosity where there shouldn't be. The horse might be going through the motions, but with his ears pinned back, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes you have to change the dynamic even in real experienced people. But, I think that if everyone knew what the outcome of that could be, once somebody can experience that kind of relationship with a horse, then you don't mind doing the groundwork. But you have to believe, you know, it's hard to convert people to that because people think they don't want to do any groundwork. You know,
they just want to get on and ride.
But your relationship begins on the ground, and you have to do it to get that kind of relationship with the horse.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Julie, this has been a great interview. Well, I think we've covered a lot of information. Just wanted to give our listeners your website, which is juliegoodnight.com, and they can find the Master DVD set and all of your training articles. And I have to commend you on your website because it's just there's so much information on your website that you give out.
The training library, I've been compiling for about 15 years now, and it's they're real life Q&As and the answers that I've written. And so it's a great resource for people, and it drives a lot of traffic to our website, which is not why I did it. I did it to give people
Sorry. Start that over.
I did that to give the people the information they need to solve problems and get along better with their horses. So I hope everybody will go there and spend some time looking around. You like, almost guaranteed you can find a problem that you've had before.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, is there anything that you wanted to send us off with, or?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of things, and even mm-hmm. even though you're talking about something specific like the canter cue or a lead problem, really ultimately you have to go back to understanding the horse's behavior and its motivations and how he thinks. Before you can be incredibly successful with horses, you really have to have an understanding of those things. So it's not just about working on your riding. It's about having a better understanding of horses naturally, they're behaviorally. That kind of unlocks a lot of doors.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the time and all the information, and I think we're ready to wind this up a bit.
Sounds good. Thanks, Sherry.